And our next speaker is Egbert Schwartz. He is a professor in the Center for Ecosystem Science and Society at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. And his research interests include microbial ecology and ecosystem ecology. And he has extensive experience using stable isotope probing to help characterize which microbial populations are actually active. Because for all of us who study marginal systems and desert systems, the paradigm is that 90% of the microbes are not active, and usually they're just waiting for that one rainfall event.
We could go to a system where plants are not in control.
No, that's because there are no plants in the system. I'm going to talk about microorganisms in soils in the McMurdo Dry Valleys in Antarctica. So this is Antarctica, a continent. There are two American food stations in Antarctica. One is Palmer Station, which is on the peninsula here, and the other one is McMurdo Station right here, which is on Ross Island, and the McMurdo Dry Valleys are right outside of McMurdo Station. So here's Ross Island. There's the Ross Ice Shelf, which connects Ross Island with the continent. And then close to Ross Island are the McMurdo Dry Valleys. And I will be talking mostly about soils in Taylor Valley right here. So the way you get to this place is you take a jet from New Zealand, Christchurch, land on the ice right outside of the McMurdo Ridge, and then you take a helicopter Taylor Valley. I find helicopters scary. And this is what it looks like, the Dry Valleys. There are very large glaciers. Right here, there are mounts of 6,000-7,000 feet. And then there is exposed soil. You can see there's actually lots of water in the McMurdo Dry Valleys, but it is all in the form of ice. And so it is a dry place, a freeze-dried kind of place.
And these soils in the McMurdo Dry Valleys, very, very little organic carbon, very little nitrogen. They are highly alkaline soils, and there's quite a bit of variation in conductivity. I will be talking mostly about the low salinity soils, which have about a conductivity of 100 microsievers. So microbiologists have been studying the soils in the McMurdo Dry Valleys for a while. And the first attempts were to try to culture stuff from the soils. And they had difficulties in doing so. They got some isolates, but they were unremarkable. And that, of course, caused people to criticize the studies and say, oh, these are probably contaminants, because they would expect remarkable isolates to come out of the McMurdo Dry Valley soils.
Then in about the 80s, people started extracting DNA from the McMurdo Dry Valley soils.
Now, of course, it is possible that the DNA is blown in on dust, aeolian input, and that the organisms aren't really growing in the McMurdo Dry Valleys. We started sequencing the DNA that was extracted from these McMurdo Dry Valley soils, and indeed the phyla that we encountered were not all that remarkable. They are very similar to the phyla that we find in soils around the world. They were dominated in red by Acinetobacteria. We find those very commonly in soils. The Actinobacteria in blue, also very common soil phyla. Bacteroidetes we often find in soil. Dinococcus firmicutes, these are all very common soil phyla.
So the question then becomes, are these microorganisms actually growing in the McMurdo Dry Valley soil? Are they active there? Or are they simply blowing in on the dust? What do you think?
They're active.
You go for active. How would you test it? No, you could do much simpler than SIP. So the first approaches, and this is data from Dave Van Horn, University of Mexico, collaborator of mine on these studies, would be to manipulate the soils.
So here we're looking at respiration on the y-axis. This refers to low salinity, medium salinity, and high salinity plots. So we had three different plots in Taylor Valley that he was looking at. And If you added water or carbon, and carbon in this talk will be a leachate of a microbial mat from lakes in the Taylor Valley, what you would find is greater respiration as you add stuff to it. Compelling evidence of microbial activity or not? You? Yes? No?
You're a hard one.
Does it prove in situ?
Why not?
Because if you're adding water, are you adding it at the same temperature?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. That is, that this does not represent the natural conditions under which these microorganisms would normally grow. When they looked at the bacterial communities in these manipulations, they were different from each other. So this is an ordination plot. Are you guys familiar with these ordination plots? You know, so replicates are by the same color. When they're close together, it means they're more similar to each other. And what you can see is this clustering happening on this ordination plot, which the soil samples that did not receive water or this cyanobacterial extract, they cluster together over here. Here are the water samples, and here are the ones that receive carbon. And so these microorganisms, the microbial communities, changed. And therefore, what?
I'm sorry, what time period?
These are month incubations.
And to look at a little more detailed, if carbon was added, they saw a large increase in the firmicutes. So these are the low, they used to be called low GC gram-positive bacteria. Bacillus clostridia are common genera in this group. They form endospores as well. If carbon was added, the acidobacteria in red, which are often thought to be oligotrophic kind of organisms, don't grow very fast, but they plummet. One of the biggest challenges, in my opinion, in soil microbial ecology is this question right here. And that is, when we see a change in community, in the microbial community, why does a change occur? Is it because stuff is growing or because stuff is dying? And those two are, of course, not exclusive of each other, because stuff is probably growing and dying all the time. Let me illustrate that with these hypothetical pie charts right here. Imagine that this is a result of a sequencing library. There are five different species. There's a treatment, and after we sequence the community again, well, there's a change in the pie chart. And we presume that the size of the pie does not change when we do this. And if that's the case, then we would say that this organism right here has become more abundant, and this organism over here has died. And that is often interpretation. But the problem is, we are having a very hard time estimating, quantifying the size of the pie, of the total microbial biomass. So here is a different example, where actually the size of the pie becomes smaller after the treatment. And that would mean that this organism right here actually hasn't changed at all. Has not changed in abundance. Does that make sense to you? And so we are struggling with quantitative extraction of nucleic acids from the environment. And because we cannot get our hands on that number very well, we are stuck with measuring stuff in relative abundances. You agree with that? Or you're... Because I'll take challenges, too, in the middle of the talk. And so if we go back to this, did these firmicutes grow upon carbon addition? Or are these just endospores in the soil, and upon carbon addition, all kinds of stuff started dying? Maybe nematodes got really active after a bunch of carbon was added to soil. You challenged me. Because I don't know, that's the... I would think if you add carbon to soil, it'd get bigger, but... Okay. So it is possible to
to label nucleic acids in soil with a variety of different compounds, with stabilized compounds that are partially made up of stable isotopes. And an example would be 18O water. So if you add 18O water to a soil sample and microorganisms grow, that is, cell division occurs, the 18O water will be incorporated into the DNA of the microorganisms over time. And so here is a result of an experiment in which we measured delta 18O of DNA that we extracted from soil. On the x-axis is incubation time in hours, and you can see that we observed a linear increase in the amount of 18O atoms that were incorporated into DNA. If there is no enzymatic activity, the 18O does not get incorporated into DNA. So it requires biological activity for the 18O to be incorporated into the DNA. And we've done a bunch of different experiments, but we find that the rate at which the 18O gets incorporated into DNA seems to be highly representative of growth. So if we add more nutrients to the soil, TSB stands for tryptic soil broth, increase the nutrient concentration in soil, then after 48 hours of incubation with 18O water, we see also more 18O incorporated into the DNA. Yeah? This is an example of a Ponderosa pine soil in the lab. The Antarctica experiments are incubations in the field. But Antarctica does not allow stable isotopes to be released in the environment, and so they are in falcon tubes in the field. It is possible to use a wide variety of different substrates in stable isotope probing. 13C was the first one that was used as stable isotope, 13C labeled methane. But there are some advantages, in my opinion, to using 18O water. And they include avoiding the fertilization artifact. So water is not a nutrient source. It is not an energy source. It is used primarily as a solvent by life. And it also allows study of environmental factors like temperature or pH or salinity or complex carbon compounds, which are not readily labeled with 13C or 15N, can be used in 18O water SIF studies. You guys are going to ask questions, right, if this stuff doesn't make sense? So briefly explain stable isotope probing to you. What we do is we incubate a sample with 18O water. In the case of the Antarctica studies, we would incubate them for a month out in the field. Sometimes we incubate much shorter. We find that 24-hour incubation is the minimum amount of time required for incubations, depending, of course, what ecosystem we're studying. But in California grassland soils, for instance, we start seeing signals after about 24 hours. We then extract the DNA from these samples, and these are very small samples that we're working with, and the reason being that 18O water is an expensive compound to buy. It's about $100 per gram. Sometimes you get better deals, $50 per gram. But we don't have like a huge 55-gallon barrel in the back of a truck that we irrigate field plots with. Extract DNA from the samples and spin the DNA in the ultracentrifuge. What you see right here, this is an ultracentrifuge tube, and it has a mixture of DNA, both labeled and unlabeled, shown in red and blue. This is an ultracentrifuge rotor. We spin for about 3 days, 60,000 RPM or so, 120,000 Gs. And what happens over that spin is that the heavier DNA, which has the stable isotope incorporated in it, so either 13C as in this example, but also 18O labeled DNA is possible. That DNA will end up lower in the tube than the light DNA. And so this DNA would represent the DNA of organisms that have grown during the incubation and incorporated the isotope. This DNA up here is the light DNA, and that represents organisms that did not grow in the incubation. After the spinning, we take the ultracentrifuge tube and we collect fractions from the bottom of the ultracentrifuge tube. We collect 16 to 20 fractions out of our ultracentrifuge tube. Other people, which are more diligent than we are, like Steve Blazewicz as an example, might collect 60 fractions, you know, but he's kind of a masochist.
Hey, Bert.
Yeah.
What temperature were they incubated at compared to, and what was the temperature of the fuel?
In Antarctica?
In Antarctica.
Yeah, so it varies. So these are field incubations, often close to freezing is the temperature.
And what does it mean by the field? Like, are you in your helicopter?
I don't own a helicopter, just for the record. but field, this is, let's see. That is what is meant by incubating in the field.
Okay. And so what was that temperature?
It's close, it's right around freezing, right in the low 30s. It probably heats up in the day, up middle 30s, upper 30s, and then, but no, because it's sunlight 24 hours a day. So depending on the weather patterns. Yeah. Okay, okay, so we end up with 16 to 20 fractions that come out of this ultracentrifuge tube. That makes sense? Everyone's with me so far? Yep. And we measure the density of each fraction using a refractometer. This is a digital refractometer. Basically measures the concentration of the cesium chloride salt that's used to separate the nucleic acids. And the concentration of the cesium chloride salt is reflects the density of the sample. We also measure the DNA concentration in each sample, and we can do that with a fluorimeter, as it's shown right here, or we often use a plate reader. This is a little qubit reader that Invitrogen makes. And so we can make this curve, where we have DNA concentration on the y-axis and the density of the sample on the x-axis. And each of these dots represents a fraction that came out of the bottom of the ultracentrifuge tube. This curve makes sense to you? Yep. And for our experiments, we always have a non-labeled, so regular water control, which is shown here in the filled circles, and then in the open circles, we have the 18-0 water control. And we compare the non-labeled incubation with the 18-0 water incubation. You can see that at a higher density right here, the open circles, there's more DNA in these samples than in the non-labeled control, in the dark circles. And so the DNA in these samples represents the DNA of organisms that have grown during the incubation. We then sequence every single fraction in these stable isotope probing experiments. And so for each of these fractions, we get the relative abundance of a specific species. Does that make sense to you? So this each sample is sequenced in this pie chart that all these different colors might represent all the different species that we detect in that sample. And with that information, then, we can make taxon-specific density curves.
So why would the fractions be different, those four that seem equidistant from their controls? They just have a different amount of 18 water incorporated into their DNA?
So you mean these four right here?
Weren't those different fractions from
the tube? Yeah, these are different fractions from the tube. And so they each have, they have four different densities. Right? And the place that a DNA sequence ends up in the tube is, two factors matter. One is how much 18-0 is incorporated into DNA sequence. And the DNA of a single taxon doesn't have to all end up in the same spot, because some of the cells might not grow, which means their DNA is going to be higher of that population of that taxon, is going to be higher in the tube, whereas the cells of that taxon that did grow would end up lower in the tube. Okay, so it's important that you understand this curve, the crux of the top. This is a taxon-specific density curve, and the example for this one is an Arthrobacter, which is a common soil bacteria. The way this curve is calculated is in filled circles now is the 16-0 curve. By taking the relative abundance that the Arthur Baxter sequence was in the sequencing library and multiplying it times the total amount of DNA that was in that fraction. So if the Arthur Baxter was not present in this sample right here, it would end up being a zero in the Arthur Baxter specific density curve. If Arthur Baxter was highly dominant over here, then it is the relative abundance of Arthur Baxter multiplied times the concentration of DNA in this sample that would result in the spot for the Arthur Baxter specific density curve. You guys with me still or not? Okay. And so we can take these curves and we can ask how much does the average density of this Arthur Baxter shift with the incubation. And the amount that it shifts is representative of how much this Arthur Baxter grows during the incubation. So we went to Antarctica. This is me on the left, that's Dave on the right. And we incubated soil samples with 18-0 water. And as you can see, the organisms grew. On the left here is a 16-0 water incubation. On the right are two tubes with 18-0 water. And you can see that a heavier band forms in the tubes because the microorganisms grew in the soil samples and the 18-0 from the 18-0 water was incorporated into their DNA. Yep.
Very surface soil, 5 centimeters.
Correct. Yep. And it is possible now to do experimental manipulations. Here's the control sample to which only a water was added. And you can see that especially Proteobacter grew a lot. So each of these lines represents a specific population within the proteobacteria. On the x-axis is atom percent excess. That's how much 18-0 is incorporated into the DNA of the organisms. You see that lots of different proteobacteria grew. A lot of Bacteroidetes grew as well. The acidobacteria, shown here in light green, did not grow as much. If we add carbon, greater number of species started growing, but the amount that they grew was actually less. If you look at atom percent excess, it is rare to find many organisms with more than 0.5 atom percent excess, which means that they did grow a lot. Whereas if no carbon was added, a lot of organisms seemed to incorporate a lot of 18-0. Yeah, you agree with that?
I agree with you.
Okay. I'm closing quickly. If we did a nitrogen manipulation, we didn't see as many organisms grow as in with carbon. It was very similar to control. But again, the amount of 18-0 that was incorporated was less than under control situations. If we manipulated salt concentration in the soil, you know, we really saw very few organisms that were actually growing, or they were much fewer than control samples, and they also grew a lot less. And these Venn diagrams represent how many species grew in comparison between two different treatments. So here you see the control versus nitrogen, and you can see that 168 species grew in both control and nitrogen treatments. But there were a similar number that only grew either in control or in nitrogen. And in the saline treatments on the bottom, you see that there were very few organisms that grew in saline but not in the control. And there were lots of organisms, 134, that grew in the control samples but not in the saline samples. We can find phyla-specific patterns. So the Bacteroidetes, for instance, all tend to grow better in blue under control conditions. And when carbon or nitrogen or salt is added, the amount of 18-0 that is incorporated into their DNA declines dramatically. For the proteobacteria, carbon or nitrogen does not affect their growth rate. It is salt that causes a decline in their growth rate. And there are people I want to thank, and I think I'm over time. So.
Great questions.